We've taken our Those Were the Days microphones out to the Pheasant Run Playhouse in St. Charles, Illinois, where Hans Conried is starring in Norman, Is That You? Right now through February 7th. And if you haven't gotten out here yet, you better mark that date on your calendar, because you wouldn't want to miss seeing a great man in a great show. And we've got a man right here, and that is Hans Conried. Welcome to Those Were the Days, Hans.
Thank you, Chuck. It's good to be here.
Hey, we'd like to talk a little bit about the good old days of good old radio.
You
and
want
maybe
to see an old man cry?
Oh, you won't cry. Can we take you away from the world of the stage and television for a little while and through the magic of radio?
I think they'd be very grateful, probably.
The stage would be? We'd like to turn the clock back maybe 25 or 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
A young man named Hans Conried gets his first radio job in Hollywood, is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
What was
that?
Well,
euphemistically,
job?
We called it Hollywood, you mm-hmm. must understand. It was really Los Angeles.
Yeah.
We broadcast, this was KECA, was broadcast in one of the upper stories of an automobile warehouse. It was a well-established station. KECA was in those days called the aristocrat of the air, since there was no commercials. It was the private hobby of a gentleman who was had the uh-huh. the Packard Agency, a most distinguished automobile in those days. He also owned the station, KECA, that was the Blue Network.
Mm-hmm.
It was part of the
mm-hmm.
NBC combine, you see, or, you know, attached to the NBC. But this was his own little baby that he had begun on a kitchen table, actually, the entire station
really?
Function. And the station played... as late as 1935, only classical music, no popular music in those days, and it had news broadcasts. And one day they decided that they wanted to expand themselves into the world of theater, and the only thing they could do in measure comparable to the quality of their music was to have Shakespeare. And they did, since no one knew how to cut mm-hmm. Shakespeare, there were no one prepared dramatically there in that station. They had their fine news announcer act as the announcer for the show program, and they had a producer who was not too well versed in Shakespeare. But anyway, Ray, we did uncut Shakespeare, not scripts, but we took the book. We all made sure we all had uh-huh. the same book, and we started page one of Act One, Scene One, and worked right through. And those programs took 3 hours, 3.5 hours, 3 3/4 hours.
And
I heard the first broadcast in the uh-huh. series. And I had just emigrated to California from New York, and I, with all the confidence of a young man of 18, I felt that I certainly knew enough, and I applied for a job, and they hired me doing classical parts. And from that, I took many subsequent steps downward and continued as an actor in radio for a wonderful 20-year period.
My goodness, what was your salary at that time? What kind of
We worked 2 days for it, and I think I got the $12.50. Because I played three parts. They were all small parts, uh-huh. you understand. Either $12.50 or $15, which was princely. No, indeed. And during the Depression uh-huh. in California, the Depression came along later. You must remember that if you went to a supermarket in those days with a $10 bill, the boy had to help you carry the parcel out to the car if you had a car, you know.
Mm.
So that was quite... And then other things. That was one of the very best shows because of the dignity and prestige. I worked then about town for 50 cents a night.
Doing what?
Well, learning my craft.
Uh-huh.
There was a show called, there was a very successful show in New York called It Happened, A March of Time.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a cheap carbon copy of it called It Happened Today. And there were five of us who got paid 50 cents a night. I remember in one program, I played in a 24-minute, 30-minute show was 24 minutes, I think, something.
Uh-huh.
I played 18 parts.
18?
Well, now these aren't really parts, they were lines, because, uh-huh. you know, Hitler said, so-and-so and I would come in with the German line, then I would do a French line, then I would do Joe Louis, who was the boxing champion, you know, and these weren't parts, but you had to change your voice,
yeah.
and it was, as I say, learning your craft.
And
we used to get then $2.50 for making a 30-minute recording, which was processed and then sold over and over again, a series very like the soap operas that you had in Chicago.
Of the same show?
No, of different sorts of shows.
Oh,
no,
oh.
An outfit called McGregor Solly that later became C.P. McGregor's. There was another man mm-hmm. working there at the same time, a black-faced comedian by the name of Bob Burns. and he had to write his own show and did it all himself with the music. He had not yet invented his famous bazooka. But he was paid because he wrote and performed. He was paid $5 a piece. And these are still owned by, you know, and you sold your rights outright for the $2.50 or $3, as we the actors did. He sold his rights outright for $5 a side. And these are still being played in Australia and New Zealand the far northern reaches of Canada and South Africa. I don't know, they must net maybe 50, 60 cents of playing, the owner still, but it's been 35 years.
That's really great. That shows the lasting quality of radio.
Or the very modest standards to which it attained. And that quality, then of course, we were unionized in 37, we founded AFRA, which now became AFTRA, with the addition of television. And things became financially a little better. But all in all, it was a most gratifying world because you could play so many things. You could play anything you could sound, you see.
Well, you were a master of dialect, so you could sound anything.
Well, most of us had to have such facility in order to play several parts. Before the unionization, you must remember that we were not limited. After we were unionized, we were limited. You could play two parts in a bit. Oh, then you could only play one part in a bit. But in those days, the actor with most voices worked most often. And it was not unusual for one actor to play three parts in one scene, talking to himself.
Going right back and
going
forth.
Going right back and forth, holding a duologue with yourself.
Was that tough for you?
It was tough for everyone, but it meant eating or not eating. And there was a great facility that we developed. And we were very arrogant about that facility, rather proud of ourselves. Indeed, we thought ourselves, by and large, the busy radio actors, and this goes all the way to the end of radio in 53, the year that radio died, from my standpoint as an actor, a national actor, we were rather on very good terms with ourselves, satisfied with what we could do. Indeed, I think there were some very good actors among radio actors who unfortunately never extended, when radio died, never did anything else. Perhaps they did not look, which was a big disadvantage. They did not look as they sounded, you see.
Well, I think that
leading men were not so personable sometimes.
It was a disappointment to the public.
It was a disappointment to the public. And then television was taken over by a new breed that possibly would be too young or held out of radio. And there was a reluctance to employ the old fat cats, who were certainly not fat any longer.
Well, let's see, you played on just about every major network comedy show that
well, that was
that
after the war, because you're a very young man, but there were better things before the decline, the literary decline of radio occurred at the time of the Second World War, when propaganda, when the good drama turned to necessarily to propaganda, and I did an awful lot of German voices, you know, in those days. And I always satisfy myself by saying, well, you had to play him as badly as you did because it was expected of you. But I was a member of the Mercury Company for 7 years.
With Orson Welles, right?
With Orson Welles, you see, and we did very good things. I worked for Norman Corwin a good deal, and we considered him the finest writer there was, and I think with good reason.
Didn't Arch Obler give you your first major radio job?
Yes, he was the first one to star me. And Obler did awfully good things, you know. Very distinguished actors that he employed, stars at that time, and I was always there to aid or support. And,
did you have a part in the that great famous War of the Worlds
program? No. Mr. Welles did that in New York, and he didn't pick me up for the Mercury Company until he came to Hollywood to do Citizen Kane.
No, that was in the film, Citizen Kane.
Yes, he came to California to make Citizen Kane. I had no part in Citizen Kane.
Right.
But he then required some additional actors to fatten up his radio company, you see. Because he brought with him Everett Sloan, Joe Carton, Agnes Moorhead, Dorothy Cumminger, who went back directly to New York. But he required other people, and I was one of the lucky ones that he auditioned and picked up and carried with him. And when you became part of the Mercury Company, that meant you worked every week. There was a part for you. It was a great, large part, small part, and it was that sense of camaraderie, that band of brothers, that made it about as happy and satisfying an organization as could be imagined. When you looked up and down the ranks every week and saw the splendid actors, as I say, we liked one another very much. Ray Collins, you know, and Erskine Sanford, You thought, oh, am I part of this wonderful company? And it gave you a great sense of accomplishment and pride.
It was radio stock company then.
Yes, right. Yes. Yeah. But then we were not limited to that. We did that only took 1 or 2 days a week at most. And we often could do something else on the same day.
Well, what kind of a rehearsal schedule would you get into if you, for let's say, a Mercury Theater was an hour program?
As I recall, an hour, a half hour, the later ones.
The early ones were
an hour. The big ones were
an hour,
yes, and they were hour ran through. Right. But then later he did one for Lockheed. Mm-hmm. And he did one for the, Committee for South American Affairs, something all governmental, subsidized with other commercial sponsors in there. But you would, for an hour show, you would probably work a day and a half or 2 days. You would probably get a...
From the time you got your script?
Yes, yes. And that was necessary because it was a big orchestra that had to be augmented. Frankly, when you became, in the later shows, the comedy shows that I did after the war, when comedy became fashionable, at most your schedule would begin sometime about noon, and then you do the show about 3 or 5 or 6 o'clock, prime for the West Coast. Then you'd have to come back 2 or 3 hours later and do it prime for the East Coast.
Even after the war, were they doing repeat broadcasts?
Oh, yes. I would, if my memory serves, it must have changed about 43, 44, 45, I guess.
Right, after.
The sponsors wouldn't consider. They felt that the utilization of the facility of recordings, we had no tape then, we put them on platters, would have been infra-dig. It wasn't quite honest to let you hear. You had to hear something fresh. So the two shows were done, in theory, identically.
If we could only hear something fresh today.
Yes, well, the terrible fear was for the actor that one day you would forget to show up for the second show after you'd already played the first.
They often did.
Well, not often. Well. It was a terrible fear. It was like a vision of hell, you know, to conceive that. And I don't know anyone who did, but we were always in constant fear that we would miss it.
Well, about the comedy shows, I'd like to get into that because a lot of our listeners remember.
Well, they were the latest, so they will be most remembered.
The great comedy things that you did. How long did you play Professor Kropotkin on My Friend Irma?
7 years. Every week.
Every single week.
And, of course, it never changed from week to week. I knew that always, as I recall about Kropotkin, he would come in about page 5 or 6, and then he would have a return entrance. He'd play about 2 pages there, and then he'd come back about page 22 to 24. It was just fixed pattern, you know.
Every script was
pretty much the same.
Words,
so that when we reached that point, if I tell them, listen, I've got a little sustaining show that'll pay me $25 down the hall or across town, I can't be here for the first 2 readings. I'll make the dress rehearsal. You say, of course, you know. I mean, I'd done the part so often, and that it was much easier in those days.
What was it that Professor Kropotkin used to call Irma? Wasn't there a little...
My dear young man, you will have heard that I haven't read those scripts in 25 years. His opening always was, there would be a knock on the door, and it would be, it's only me, Professor Kropotkin.
Right. Okay.
The first time Kropotkin worked, I did everyone from the second show on. In the very first show of the series, the first of 7 years of Broadcasting Weekly, he was a violinist who spoke only with his violin. And
No dialogue at all.
Uh-huh. They would talk to him, and he would make answer with his fiddle. It didn't work. So then they thought they'd have to get an actor to play some sort of a dialect comic part, you know? And I said, Kropotkin, and I was hired for it. I did a lot of dialects. Mm-hmm. And I said, Kropotkin, that's a noble Russian name. That's a knez, you know. Kropotkin is a most distinguished imperial Russian name. So I had a rich Russian accent. And that was the second show. And they said, Conrad, we like it. We like, you know, the way you handle it. We hired you for it. We don't know what the way politics are now. The Russians, of course, they're our good and our strong allies. What could you do? We don't want to make him so Russian in case anything happens. So I made him Jewish. And we never changed the name. And he was what they call in the trade a Jew comic thereafter.
Oh, that was great. Well, you switched then to... a German, a broad German character.
Well, I didn't switch. We were doing
Life with Luigi.
It was just across the hall, you see. And one was done the day after, and I'd had that for 5 years.
Gee, Schultz was the butcher, wasn't he?
Schultz was the butcher.
Yeah.
J. Carroll Nash starred in that.
Right.
And he had an Italian accent. When they first brought it up, I said, oh, my Lord, this is Kaltenmeier's Kindergarten. We haven't done that in 40 years. There's no point in doing it. But it was a good success. Joe Forte played the Jewish, but each of us had another dialect.
Yeah.
Ken Peters did the Swede, and did we have an Irishman? We must have.
Oh, I think you had just
about
everything
in the class.
And that lasted for 5 years.
That was 5 years, and that also died in 53.
Everything died in 53.
Well, it was
it?
The
just
end.
About.
It was
yeah.
the, you know, it was the Holocaust that the networks decided it was time to end that medium because they had invested in television.
Well, by 53, you were really at the peak of your radio career, at least financially.
I don't know whether it was peak. It was the end. It certainly was very sound financially and very gratifying. There was no memorization. Mm-hmm. There was none of the drudgery that is necessary to be an actor and on the stage. You had to maintain a couple of decent suits because the comedy shows particularly always had audiences. We needed the laughter. Mm-hmm. The dramatic shows were done in studios without audiences very often. Very often we were anonymous, you know. By the time the end, though, by the last few years, we began to get billing. They would credit the actors.
Now that's
and
what
then
I
the
wanted.
Public began to know us. But for many years, we worked quite anonymously. We were just voices, and the public had no idea. I did not even sure that they realized there were human beings making the sounds.
I wanted to ask you about that. Now, I know that on the Judy Canova show, you occasionally played a character by the name of Mr. Hemingway.
Well, but your memory is much keener than mine. And I played a couple of characters, probably, but with Canova because she was a rural comic, you know.
Right.
Mel Blanc was on it, Ruby Dandridge, and Sheldon Leonard, who's now a very prominent producer, and Joe Kearns, of course, did Lukey. I had two or three. I had an affected English character and a stock
Boswell
comic.
Out of the all the research, I find a name called William Boswell. Did you remember
such
a name?
No, but I know the sort of things.
Well, you were
I
on Gildersleeve too, weren't you?
No, never played the great Gildersleeve.
Never
played the great with Hal Perry. No, or later with Willard Waterman. Never did that.
Someone said you once played Oliver Honeywell on that program.
Well, I may have once or twice. We had a show called The Great Gildersleeve that we auditioned years ago in which I was supposed to star, but we never saw it.
Oh. Well, you're on Mel Blanc program. Did you do Professor Moriarty on Sherlock Holmes?
Yes, with Basil Rathbone. And Nigel Bruce. He didn't come in very often. I did the show much more often as some other character than Moriarty, because Moriarty was a rare and villainous pleasure, so great and enormous that you couldn't use him every week, you know.
But you'd work regularly on that show. What other programs were you involved with?
I did the murderer in the original production of Sorry Wrong Number that Agnes Moorehead made so famous. Of course, it was her show from beginning to end, but they had a voice. I played a Dutch dialect, a Holland accent, and that I remember. Did it two or three times thereafter. There was an annual celebration of Christmas, the Christmas show that Lionel Barrymore did.
A Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol. I did Marley's Ghost for 9 consecutive years. It was an annual show, and they made a big to-do about it every year on Christmas Eve.
We know very well. That was it's one of my favorite programs
of all
time.
Are there still recordings? There is an album that Mr. Barrymore made, which was not up to the standard of the annual show for some reason. They didn't spend enough money
on it. But you were on it, I think, aren't you?
Well, I'm also associated with lesser shows as well as the most successful ones, you know. I mean, we felt disappointed. It wasn't quite as stylish as the annual show. They didn't afford the big orchestra or anything.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and they bridged each.
And I was on the Lionel Barrymore show for some years on alternate weeks, as I've forgotten that.
You mean the mayor of the town?
Yes, mayor of the town. I was Marilli's boyfriend. I was Aggie's boyfriend. Blowhard.
Was that with credit
that
or not?
With credit, with I'm credit. Sure. That was late in the career in the radio days. And I did it for several years on alternate weeks. There were two writers. One writer used me and the other one didn't.
With the prejudice?
One was my friend. I don't think he was prejudiced. No, he just felt that there was a character the other man had developed. The other man wrote best. And a writer took 2 weeks to write the show, and they alternated. It was a weekly show.
You did a show with John Wayne a long time ago.
Three Sheets to the Wind. My Lord, you've done a lot of research.
Now, what was that show
about? That was a recorded
about?
Show and sold syndicated. Had no definite sponsor, you know. Must have been about 30 minutes long. I can't tell you. Three Sheets to the Wind. Cost me a certain amount of adventure and drinking. And a wonderful man directed it. A very prominent motion picture director who had not done much radio directing and who was a sailor. It was a yachting story, something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It maybe ran 13 weeks and died. It was not long lived.
Was that in the late 30s at that time, or was it in the
maybe
40s?
Maybe early 40s, very early 40s.
You did some radio directing.
Oh, yes.
For a while.
Stars Over
years.
Hollywood.
You directed Stars
yes,
Over Hollywood.
Yes, television was beginning to come in. And this agent thought that I talked well. There was very little direction to be done, you understand. I'm a star. What was it? A very big agency. It owned a lot of shows. They would contract prominent motion picture stars. And in the very small print, there would be, they'd get a certain amount of money for a block of three shows that they would do over the course of a year. And the Stars Over Hollywood, which was an early Saturday morning show, was the least of these. And they only wanted someone who was well-known. And most of these people I had supported. And I was a well-known radio actor. And I knew them. And we were on a first-name basis. And they used me as kind of a front. What can you tell an actor who comes in? And they used to pay them off very modestly because their main salary came from the bigger shows that they contracted. Plus a can of tin meat, a case of tin meat they gave them because it was Armistar, or a ham or something. And so my function was only, it was very easy to be a radio director at this point because you had your tremendous source of performers and you only had to cast the parts according to what you knew each actor could do, you know.
Was that the extent of your radio directing, or did you do other things?
I didn't do that exclusively. That took Friday night late and Saturday morning, and I was free to continue as a radio actor. I functioned as a radio actor at the same time. Yeah. But I had that questionable distinction of also being a radio director for 3 years.
Now, along about the time when you first, you were had been involved in radio for several years, and I guess it was 1938 when you made your first motion picture.
I cannot say how flattered and flabbergasted I am that you would have done this.
You're
much
my
research.
Hero. You're my hero.
Really, you should have seem more sensible than that. You should have more worthy idols than them.
No, come on now. You did dramatic school.
Than to kneel at my feet of clay.
In 1938.
That was 1938. That was the first picture I'd done. So you see, I had been a radio actor since virtually December or November of 35. I came out to California in September. So I'd been an actor for a couple of years before I got that small part in a picture. And was I continued to do small parts for a long time.
Was it tough to get a movie job at that time, or easy?
Well,
because of your radio
background. The business was burgeoning, you know. Radio actors, I think, were in some disfavor. Motion picture producers didn't know they existed, actually. Radio was looked down upon. It was a bastard industry. It was not until about that time, well, about 35, 36, that it became fashionable or even permissible for motion picture stars to appear on radio. Radio had its own group of pariahs who performed vocally, but they felt that it was beneath the dignity of an established star to appear on, a motion picture star to appear on radio. And then someone's nephew got the idea, let's bring him into the, there was now a decline in motion picture sales. First run pictures, I think, used to cost about 75 cents a ticket in those days. That was the first run, and second runs were 40 and 25 cents or 15 or whatever they went to. Let's bring them into the living room, your living room. So suddenly, motion picture actors began to be the big stars in Hollywood. Well, there was no industry in Hollywood. The industry at that time was San Francisco. So within a few months, the tremendous industry in San Francisco declined, and all the radio actors came down to Los Angeles. However, I had been, and several others, many others, some years before, had been holding forth in their quiet, anonymous, almost invisible way of being radio actors. Well, these motion picture stars required radio actors about them to support them, people who thoroughly knew the business and were able to play all these other parts. And so everything opened up for us marvelously. Then in 37, because we had, to make the best of it, questionable working conditions, Screen Actors Guild, when we said we wanted to go on strike, that we wanted to get a better wage, something more than the 50 cents a night, the 350 and the 250, that had nurtured us and maintained us and enabled us to learn our craft, then Screen Actors Guild said, yes, if you go out, we'll stand by you. We'll go out too. Otherwise, they could have filled it up with persons who had not been doing any radio work at all. And they permitted us to organize. And from that time on, the industry was thriving and remunerative for all of us who had prepared ourselves by working for nothing for years before.
Oh, that's great. You know, in the late 30s and the early 40s, you were, as a character actor, you were probably a Hollywood's resident Nazi, weren't you?
Oh, yes. That was actually a small. But that's a great many things in pictures I did.
Right, that's what I mean.
You see, I was, radio was my primary business. Mm-hmm. Most of my living came. However, because of the German name and the fact that I did German dialects and I was young and slender enough to wear the uniform with some effect, they hired me. I have photographs of myself in every possible German uniform of that SSSR, Wehrmacht, Luftwaffe, everything, Partei uniform. And so then I began to get, although my parts were small, I began to get even featured spots. The very of the parts was small because I had enough prestige and I had enough protection from my radio business to make myself slightly unavailable in pictures like that, mm-hmm.
Well, they often would work.
They'd work around
your schedule,
I'd say,
right?
It's a very small part. You've only got 2 days. When aren't you working? And I said, well, next week I have Wednesday and Thursday. You know, and so I'd go out and do a picture, and it was fine for me. But that's, I never did many pictures. Never got very good parts.
You were in that, I think, three of the Falcon movies, weren't you?
Couple of them anyway.
Yeah.
George Saunders' brother.
Tom Conway.
Tom Conway, yeah. That's right.
I love the one title.
Irving
of one
Reese
of them,
was
the Gay Falcon.
The Gay Falcon.
Yeah. You think that we could produce a film like that today?
Well, not only that, but they'd really follow through with the story. In those days, it was only the title that was provocative.
I played
a hotel clerk in one. I saw because I have an old still. And I did a murder in another in which I died in a bee smoke cemetery. They shoot me in a cemetery.
That's a good spot to die.
Yes.
You were in a Maisie film. And you I know you did. You may not remember you did, but I know you were on a couple of the Maisie radio programs, The Adventures of Maisie.
Oh, lots of that was Ann Southern.
Right.
Oh, I did
Southern.
Lots of those. And then we had a show called Blondie, too. And I did that was a good big part. And I got some little celebration for that, Blondie's Blessed Event. It was what we called B-pictures.
The movie.
They were dreadful movies. And there was a newspaper in New York that gave me a tabloid picture, a paper called PM. Not many people remember it. And they gave me a full page. They reproduced a still, said picture stealer caught red-handed. I began to get do small parts, but they were very often good parts.
Well, you were the voice of Mr. Darling and Captain Hook in Disney's Peter
later.
Pan.
Oh, that was
in
52 or 53.
Yeah.
That was a cartoon. Well, I did done cartoons all along, voiceover.
Mm-hmm. Were you doing the 7-minute cartoons for
lots
studios?
Of cartoons for studios, the things that they'd show in motion picture theaters, you know, as a divertissement between the A picture and the B picture.
Right. They don't make cartoons like they used
to make
either.
They don't make cartoons anymore.
Yeah.
Although there are some great artists in cartooning far beyond. Mm. I work for Jay Ward, and I feel that Jay Ward produces the finest stuff.
Jay Ward was
the Bullwinkle Show, or their old ones now. And I've done Snively Whiplash on Dudley Do-Right Show, and I do Uncle Waldo on Hoppity Hooper. Now, in theory, they're for kids, but if you listen to them, the dialogue, I know we enjoy doing them because they're very witty.
Oh, sure.
And the style of cartooning has changed.
Didn't you do a show that was it produced by Jay Ward, this Fractured Flickers?
Flickers, that's right, a series.
What did you think of that show?
I enjoyed it very much, and it was very well received. College people liked it very much. When I go to colleges, the kids like it. It was impractical, too expensive to produce. They had to look at so much old footage in order to get a 30-minute show. You know, you'd spend 2 days in the viewing room, say, and you'd stop the camera and say, wait a minute. Back in reel two, there are a couple of frames that I could tie into this because I've got a gag, you know. But it meant going back and cutting, and the editing is just more than could be afforded.
Well, how long did that thing run? Was there
26 shows or something, 13. It's being reshown in California, and, you know, it's a timeless thing now.
Well, people are very nostalgic
these
days. Oh, sure. I want to ask about the Peter Pan thing. Didn't you, in addition to doing the voice for Captain Hook, have something to do with the actions for the animators?
I did the live action. You see, Disney alone is the only studio large enough to afford live action. Mm-hmm. Live action is an absolute movie made under very hot lights, very bright lights, some strange, I think it's 25 millimeter or something, strange film size. and you wear costume and you have elementary sets, just the rudiments of the mm-hmm. set, and you perform. Now, when you do voiceover in a picture, as I often used to do, I was employed to dub, for instance, they'd get a very interesting looking character man and he could speak English. And then I'd dub whatever he would say in his heavy dialect into a thinner dialect.
Mm-hmm.
You then speak your lines coincident with the actor's labial action on the screen. You put the sound to the picture. But with Disney's cartoon, since the sound is the primary, and their picture will be drawn, will be cartooned, you make the sound first. You make your soundtrack. And then, of course, they usually do not hire the same actor to do the physical action. Invariably, they usually hire dancers.
Mm-hmm.
too, because they are more subtle and their pantomime is more developed than the average actor. But in this case, they thought that I would do, and they hired me, and it took over 2.5 years and fits and starts to complete. And in that way, I enacted the role physically, coincident with the soundtrack that was always played behind me. You see?
How interesting.
Well, it was an interesting thing, and we did it over, as I worked on that, over 2.5 years, I say. Well, not consistently, but they say, listen, next week, can you give me 2 days? Or mm-hmm. next week, we've got 4 days. Or next month, you got to give me 2 full weeks. We've got a lot of series to shoot. Mm-hmm. And then a picture would be made where my physical action would be coincident with the sound that was on the track.
But what a beautiful job.
And the cartoonist then, mm-hmm. this picture was developed. And they said, now, wait a minute. When he says that, what happens to the plume on his hat? What's he do with his hand? How about his eyebrow? And they could stop action with this thing, blow them up. They're common in the animator's room. 18 by 25 inches, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they could see exactly at what point in the picture. So that's why Disney's stuff was so precise and so natural.
Amazing. It's amazing.
It was the only other people that can do that are the governmentally sustained Eastern European cartoons. You sometimes see them bought. I did some translating, a voiceover for translated mm-hmm. Polish and Russian things, and they are marvelously done, but they are sustained by the government, and you even have highlights on buttons in the cartoons shining and teeth breaking. That's all because they have made an absolute and complete movie that I believe in many instances they've just traced into cartooning.
Let's slip back just a little bit from Disney to a movie that you were and weren't in as Professor Kropotkin in My Friend Irma. Tell us about that.
Well, I had done it for 7 years, you know,
mm-hmm.
the part. And when it came, they wanted to make a picture of it. It was the first picture that Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin did together. They introduced them into the character. They were two young, brash young comics, and they were looking for a vehicle, and this radio show was so popular, but now radio was dying. It was close to the end. See, I don't remember what year, but it could have been more, a year or so short.
49.
Was it 49? Well, it
was
4 years before. Anyway, the same man produced it, and he called me and said, Conrad, you want to do Kropotkin? It's your part. You've done it enough. 4 or 5 years. And I assured him that as eager as I was to become a famous movie star, that I was quite an unsuitable. I was in my late 20s or early 30s. No, I guess, what did you say, 49?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you exactly. In 47, I would have been 30, so I was 32. But there was an old man of about 75, and I said, no, it's ridiculous. Not for me, and I'm busy elsewhere, and I thank you, and if you get a nice part for a younger man, I'd be happy to play it, but there wasn't. So they got a marvelous actor, and they very wisely got Felix Braeseart, splendid European actor, to play the part, and he was wonderful in it. But he died halfway during the shooting. And they said, now we're in trouble. So I said, all right, put the makeup on me, and I'll play the part. And I did play it. And I played it, as I thought, with a face much too young for the part. They had to use me just either slightly out of focus or a little far back. But the best portions of that entire performance are the long shots, which were originally done by Braeseart. So there was one character in this movie that was played by two actors. I was much taller than Braeseart anyway. But we both had big noses and were thin, and they edited it so that perhaps the average viewer didn't recognize that there were two actors playing the part.
But there you were, your screen achievement as Professor Kropotkin.
Well, it was something. I've often done things I shouldn't do. That was certainly one of them.
The film which you have said was the highlight of your motion picture career as far as being an artistic success was a great picture in 1953 called The 5,000 Fingers.
5,000 Fingers of Dr. Thee. My mother saw it. And I don't think anyone else. My kids have seen it at college because it's considered a classic now. But at its time, it was one of the two great money losers of all time. You see, it was a great debacle.
But you had the title role.
I had the title role. It was the biggest part I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Maybe the biggest, the best part I ever will get. If it had come out differently, it would have changed my life, no doubt. But it was such a, it became such a stock joke. It would stop conversation in any cocktail party in Hollywood thereafter. That it was very hard, almost, I don't know that they blame me personally for the debacle because the other actors were involved, but we were all hurt bad. It did very well in London and Berlin, Paris, and Tokyo. But in those days, our foreign market didn't pay. I don't think it ever paid for its print money back. The original film that went through the camera was never paid by... it was partly politics and partly because it was a fantasy, and Americans weren't prepared for anything.
Peter Lynn Hayes and Mary Healy were
That's right, and they had a tough time working after that in pictures, too. Yeah. I did work for a long time there. The only one that survived without too many scars was Tommy Reddick, and he became the boy, the first boy with the Lassie show, and he's outgrown the... his child parts now and doesn't perform any longer.
Well, what was your most recent film?
I can't remember.
Robin and the Seven Hoods in 65, well, 5 years ago, six years ago.
How about the Patsy with Jerry Lewis? That's more recent, isn't it?
That was 64. That was before that.
Well, I can't remember. It was 60, but maybe 66 or something. But they were minor and unimportant. But then already pictures were declining. And by that time, I was primarily concerned in the work I'm doing now. I'm on the stage. So the last... 12, 14 years, I'm on the stage 200 nights a year, you know, at least.
200 nights a year?
At least. 8 or 10 months a year, if I'm lucky, and I have been.
Well, anyone who comes to see you when you're on the stage is very lucky.
Well, on the good nights sometimes.
No.
They have nothing else to do. But that is what I've been doing. I suppose it indicates, and I'm very happy and grateful for the chance to be resilient, that I've had 3 or 4 careers shot out from under me, and I'm still functioning. Mm-hmm. After 35 years, I'm working almost every week somewhere doing something.
Well, you're involved regularly, if not every week, on something on television. You're,
I suppose, repeats or something.
Uncle Tunus.
Oh, but I do voiceovers and cartoons, you don't know, and I do talks and lectures. And also, I have several strings to my bow, and it's almost necessary.
Do you think that a good dramatic series produced today could survive on radio?
I wouldn't think so. No, where would you find your audience? You and your family?
Well,
the American public
has.
I don't know.
That.
I wonder if it could.
If the opportunity arose, the
radios
would
now.
You
I
be
remember
a
my,
part
when
of it?
My little girl asked me some years ago, "What did you do before you became an actor?" I said, "Well, I was always an actor. When I was very young, I was a radio actor." She said, "You mean that thing in the automobile?" Well, you know, that concept of radio is only if you can hear it over the whir of the automobile motor. The engine.
But if a program were being produced like that, would you like to be a part
of
it?
Oh, very much. Very much.
You liked radio.
Yes,
you
very much. We thought I felt very secure in that. I felt I knew my craft.
You did. You did. We'd like to thank you for being part of our Those Were the Days show,
Chuck.
Today. Hans Conried, we can't say how much it's been our pleasure.
I can't tell you again how flattered I am that anyone looked all this nonsense. I don't know where you found the material. Most of it I forgot.
I'd like to invite our listeners to head out to the Pheasant Run Playhouse in St. Charles to see Norman, Is That You? Great comedy.
Thanks.
A good comedy and a good star. Hans Conried, our guest today. Thank you very much, Hans, for being with us.